Hello and welcome to the Permaculture Podcast with Scott Mann, a listener-supported program. My guest for this episode is Josh Trott of The Acres in New Hampshire. Josh is a working farmer, woodworker, educator, and, might I dare say, community builder. He was suggested to me on the Facebook page for the show, facebook.com/thepermaculturepodcast. Having heard his name mentioned several times, I figured I should reach out to him sooner rather than later. In this conversation, we start, as usual, with his background and how he came to be a working farmer, and a name known in the permaculture community. The experiences of how he got to this place forms the ground we walk over while discussing his work starting, growing, and looking into the future of D Acres. As is often the case in these interviews, he is candid about the mistakes, successes, and the amount of work that actually goes into making a go at this kind of project. Though it took time, that effort is now paying off. If you find this interview or any of the others in the archive useful, please consider making a donation to the show. Through one-time or small recurring micro-donations, you help me to continue to produce these interviews and other topical podcasts. Find out how you can help by going to thepermaculturepodcast.com/support. Now then, on to the interview with Josh Trott. I'll join you afterwards with some thoughts and updates. Oh, and even if this isn't an interview you would normally listen to, stick around for when Josh starts talking about using pigs as part of his land development strategy. It's near the end, but well worth it. As you'll hear, I had a good laugh.
Then, if you're ready, sir, if you could give us a bit of your background and how you came to the work you're doing, we can then begin the discussion about D Acres.
Well, I grew up as a, you know, sort of a pioneer of suburbia. My family and I had moved to North Carolina in the late 1970s when the state was going through like 7-8% growth. And so it was a time of expansion where we were all building houses, raising families, and farmland down in North Carolina. So sort of grew up in that environment with some exposure to agricultural heritage, but a really affluent type of upbringing where I didn't really get my hands awful dirty when I was a kid. As I got older, my parents are very service-oriented. They're in the field of medicine. And so I was looking to sort of follow in their footsteps and became more interested in environmental type work. Then, you know, went off to college, went to the University of Colorado, Boulder, and had a, you know, a good old time recreating and learning about all the troubles in the world. But it wasn't much for a solution-based proactive. It was more of sort of an expose on the bad things. And then from there, I was fortunate enough to find a summer program up in Carbondale, Colorado at Solar Energy International. And there I met some really superb people. Amongst them, a fellow by the name of Ed Eaton. And I spent a little time as well up at Jerome Ostenkowski's place, Crimpier, Colorado Rocky Mountain Permaculture Institute, I guess is what it's called. So that was my initial exposure to permaculture, as much as a concept, so to speak. From there, I was engaged in trying to be more active at implementing those kind of strategies and traveled around a little bit, but eventually found myself back in New Hampshire at the family homestead. And from there, we have worked really hard to develop an organization known as D Acres. Does that cover it a bit?
No, that covers it perfectly. When you mentioned spending some time up at Jerome's place and having an introduction to permaculture, have you gone through like any of the formal permaculture training that's out there? Or have you just kind of implemented what you learned into what you're doing?
Well, that's an interesting point. Well, what happened was there was, you know, the program at Solar Energy International had some sort of concurrent themes with Jerome's program. So we would go up and do like installation of a Sunny John or something up at the site that Rocky Mountain Permaculture Institute was on as part of our class. So it was sort of immersed in our studies, you know, this sort of permaculture mode of thinking. But as far as an actual design class, I never undertook to take one. By the same token, when we first came to D Acres, of our cadre of five people that more or less started the place, three of the other people had taken a design certification from the Bullocks in Washington. So it was definitely immersed in our thought process from the onset. As far as actually going through the course, I never did that until I went to Argentina and helped participate as part of a teaching type cadre, you know, more or less an assistant teacher for a design course in Argentina. But most of that was in Spanish anyway, so I didn't really catch all of that.
I've heard about that being a somewhat common route for people to go through the process, is after they have all these years of experience, someone's like, hey, you've gone through all this before, and it's, no, I've just been doing this, so why don't we do a bit of a work trade, or hey, why don't you come help me out, and then we can take it from there. But your name is one that's come up and been mentioned to me on several occasions from several different listeners, and they're like, hey, you need to talk to Josh. So everything that you're doing seems to be just the right thing to do.
Yeah, and you know, at this point, we are offering a permaculture design course here, and you know, our co-teacher has he's taken the design course as well as the teacher training and so forth with Steve Whitman. Feel pretty confident in being able to offer that level of teaching. And I, you know, from my experience, I think that the design course is a super opportunity, but there are so many different ways to get into permaculture in various different levels without necessarily taking a design course.
And that's one of the reasons why I always like to ask a guest for their background, because everyone seems to have a different way to have come to this kind of work. You say that it was you and a group of four others who came together and started D-Acres?
Yeah, four or five people. Well, I got a phone call when I was in Alaska from my mother, who informed me that my aunt was unable to more or less take on the farming duties anymore. She was 89 years old, and she just needed some help managing the homestead. There was a group of us who were at a farm on Orcas Island intermittently during like a two-year period. We sort of coalesced as a group and discussed the possibilities of taking on, you know, our own type of venture. We sort of, you know, it's typical on farms. You can get sort of disgruntled with the leadership, and you form a clique, and you feel like you could come up with something, you know, ideal or more better than where you're at. So we were doing some of that sort of Lord of the Flies behavior, and then the opportunity came about. So we had to sort of put up or shut up at that point. So we came out and, you know, with a half a bushel of garlic and a pickup truck and moved into a barn in New Hampshire. And, well, the first winter was pretty rough, put it that way.
When was that first winter?
1997. It was definitely an experience. Just sort of, I was 25 and pretty fresh and naive, inexperienced. I think as a group, we were really looking to take on the challenge of starting an operation, but having never done it, we were swimming in above our heads a little bit. It was definitely swimming upstream, struggling a bit.
So it's been a very hands-on, up to your elbows, just digging in and learning as you go?
Yeah. So, you know, trials of various means. We're very fortunate to have the support of my aunt and my family at that time to help us sort of wade through the financial piece and have some freedom to start exploring and start working with the concepts. I think that it was definitely a luxury in lots of ways to have that kind of freedom, but I think it's also sort of a necessity with the permaculture system. I mean, you're really looking for a slow bloom, so to speak. To develop your perennial system takes quite a bit of investment. So really fortunate to have the time and the space to explore the possibilities up here and to really have the time to observe this location. Because we weren't from this place. We hadn't grown up here, and we needed that kind of space to really rethink how our operations could be successful. I think we came with these notions from the West Coast that we would be able to grow exotic Asian greens for people and sell them for $20 a pound. You know, you get to the East Coast and, well, there's the growing seasons are totally different. You don't have, you know, 12 months to grow greens. And it's a situation where we have flea beetles and other pests. And shoot, the people, most of the people that want greens grow their own. It's not like a fufu market for sort of people who want to be chic. It's, Appalachia up here is a little bit more nitty-gritty. The market wasn't necessarily there for that type of operation, you know, sort of a salad green, salad bar type operation. So we evolved. We changed it as we went.
So from those early days thinking about selling greens to a higher-end market, where have things gone for you in developing this working farm?
Well, diversity. I think we came into it with this one-dimensional idea, you know, you just sort of do this and that's the key to success, you know, you do one thing well. I think what we learned first and foremost is that we live in the northern forest, we don't live in a valley type environment. This Appalachian northern forest is a very tough and resilient existing ecology. So what we learned to do was to morph into what's possible up here. And it's not really field crop agriculture. It's more of a natural resource-based agriculture where you're doing a lot of forestry, a lot of value-added wood products, and then looking at the long-term perspective, looking at more of a perennialized forest gardening type system where we are working towards recomposition of the existing species to develop a system that would parallel our goals.
As you develop that system, what are some of the goals that you're trying to accomplish?
Well, I think we're looking to meet our food requirement, our food needs, and meet them in a way that's not only nutritionally satisfying, but also savory, you know, tasteful. So the food is a very big element to us. Within the food would be other necessities. I mean, our goals are to develop a system that can meet the necessities of life and in such a way that we have some time and energy to enjoy this life. So you got your food, your shelter, your water, your clothing, your community, and your medicine needs that sort of comprise the necessities. So working towards having a farm system that meets those needs and meets those goals of providing community, providing health and wellness service, providing adequate food and water, shelter and clothing is really the basis of the system. And when we start working towards meeting those goals, then I think also the culture then develops. Because sort of through meeting life's necessities in a certain locale based on the resources is really, I think, how culture is created.
And do you feel that you're meeting those goals and that they are serving the work of D Acres?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. No, I think, I mean, like when we moved here, really sort of naive in lots of senses, but not really, not very knowledgeable in terms of food, feed the plate. I mean, some salad greens, but to develop a full four-season diet that is stable and enduring is come along quite well here. I think we're up to maybe, you know, the estimates vary, but I'd say between 60 and 80% of our food needs are being met on site. And, you know, quite often we'll go for days at a time just eating 100% of the food we grow. It's a situation where, you know, not only are we growing more crops, but we're also figuring out better ways to preserve them and extend the season, so to speak. That, to me, has been extraordinary. Just the growth from a half a bushel of garlic to a fully stocked root cellar that we're still eating potatoes and carrots from last year, sauerkraut and so forth. It's really extraordinary to have seen that and been witness to it and sort of see how it's not that hard. I mean, there's definitely some skills to be learned and some ground to be prepared, but it is a matter of just making a transition in your reality and your perspective as to what's possible. But I feel like at this juncture, we certainly eat a lot healthier than the average bear that's going to the grocery store and so forth. And it tastes better, too. Within that as well, you know, you have your food system, but you also have your shelter or housing system and infrastructure. I think we've done quite well at working towards meeting our shelter goals. We initially started with, you know, sort of this model of tree houses and really affordable shanty type homes, and have now moved towards a more permanent housing and investing more in our housing so that we can give people, it's not just a place to be overnight, it's a home. So I think that transition has also been sort of a perspective change, but it resonates, and it's really profound at some level to be a part of that shift from just providing a shelter to being a part of making homes for people. Within that too, I think the community aspect of this organization, in terms of our community outreach, has been quite a wonderful journey. When we came here, you know, moving in from the West Coast and moving to a town of 300 people, there was a lot of blowback in terms of outsiders and, you know, our ideas and talking about humanure. It can really ruffle some feathers. And so over our 16 years here, we've really worked hard to reach out to the community and to welcome interaction. This place is not designed to be an island by any means. This place is designed to interact and to connect. The idea is not to create somewhere where you have your personal oasis and, you know, some sort of catastrophe apocalypse hotel, you know what I mean? We're looking for a place that we can reach right into the community and the community can reach back, and we can work together. So see that process take place over time, from being outsiders to being accepted as positive contributing members, is very uplifting.
You never want to become some kind of a secluded compound where you're just growing your own food and away from society, but to become kind of a community center as you develop all this?
That's correct. Sort of, you know, they had a traditional agricultural sort of club around here, the Grange. And so that was sort of a traditional model to work off of, was the Grange model, but sort of, you know, like a rural YMCA, YWCA, sort of combination of a agricultural co-op and a rural support network, just looking at ways to, you know, obviously we provide educational services. You know, you can come here and learn how to compost or grow vegetables. But it's also a place where you can just come meet other people and share food. A place where you can come borrow some tools if you needed some, or, you know, come talk to people about cooperatively buying some equipment or some such. This is a place where those ideas and an open free space where that can transpire and is encouraged.
We're talking around a lot of the work that you're doing. Could you speak specifically to what D-Acres is as a site and as an idea and an organization?
Wowzers, that's going to be a good one. Okay, so as far as an organization, D-Acres is a nonprofit. It's a 501c, and we have a board of directors that governs it. I'm the co-director with Regina Rinaldo, and we have currently three staff members, and then there's usually a handful of semi-transient Wolfer-type residents that are either here for the long or short term, sort of passing through. And so over the course of 16 years now, we've had about 200-odd people of that nature, and then various people and staff such as myself. I have the longest tenure, but various people throughout that history have stayed for, you know, 2, 5, 6 years, something like that. Sort of formed to allow people to rotate through without necessarily tying them in an ownership situation. And in general, the organization is designed to transcend the typical property ownership models. I think we're looking to use the farm as a mechanism that can be shared by various people, families, groups of people, as opposed to the traditional model where it's either a corporate farm or a family-owned farm. I'm just looking at the state of the world and how farms are continually broken up through the traditional nuclear family model, through inheritance and so forth. And we also have an element of concern about how there's a lot of land trusts and land conservation type entities out there that I think their primary focus is sort of a triage preservation. And what we really, I feel like we need is ownership with entities that will encourage land tenure and the continued productivity of land through occupation. I mean, we need people to be able to inhabit these agricultural lands. So it's trying to figure out a way to work from the traditional nuclear family and allow a greater breadth of people to occupy land without, you know, more or less mortgaging the rest of their life to that one processes. Just allowing an evolution of the possibilities of land tenure. In terms of, like, what we do on a day-to-day basis, it's a whole lot of farming. Basically, we are in a very intensive gardening mode during the summer, and we're working on about 4 acres, doing handwork, no-till type, and developing our orchard and perennial plant stock. We also raise animals. We have a team of oxen that we work with in the forest, as well as we raise chickens and ducks and have pigs. We use our pigs extensively for transformational process up here. We'll go into a section of the forest and do some clearing and let the pigs after it. And then that mutualistic relationship is how we begin to build our soil and work into transforming our species from the traditional northern forest to more of this edible food forest system. I know there was a bit more to that question. You want to probe a little into that?
Well, yeah, I wrote down a couple of things here as you were going. You say that you've had the longest tenure there. Are you the only one of the original group that's still part of the organization?
At this juncture, yeah. My sister was another one who was a member, and she's got married and moved to Colorado. And then there's another fellow who moved back to Orcas, and another lady that moved back into the San Juans. And then the third gentleman who was with us is actually living in the same town as my sister in Colorado, and they see each other pretty regularly. So, more or less, I think at the time when we started, you know, Charles and Jimmy were around for 2 or 3 years, but their inclination was not to stay in Dorchester for the rest of their lives. I think they were really interested in pioneering a project and helping us get established, but for a number of reasons, I think that was the limit of what they were really capable of contributing. They didn't really necessarily have the love of New England and the love of New England winters. I also think, in some respects, I know my sister was a bit put off, it's just sort of stale socially around here. It's very, like, it's salt of the earth. You know, it's not upwardly mobile hipster people necessarily running around New Hampshire. I feel very comfortable in that environment, but I think for some folks that was a bit of a shock to the system. Whereas there's other parts where if you're interested in meeting a partner, raising a family, there's maybe other parts of the country that are a bit more urban and a bit more geared towards that. I sort of like Appalachia. I'm sort of a redneck when it comes down to it. Sorry.
No, that's okay. It's just a term that I haven't heard in a while, and I think of where I grew up. I grew up on the Potomac, and, you know, there was the idea of the river rat, and now I live in part of Appalachia here in Pennsylvania. So it's interesting where I am because it's kind of like right on that border between the exurbs and the urbanites who have moved out to have more land versus like the hill people who live here because this was where land was affordable at a particular time their family stayed. So I can understand a bit of that. Yeah, I look at where I am on the stream, which isn't real expensive, but then there are the $500,000 houses that are within a stone's throw of where I am.
Yeah, we're probably a bit further out than that, but it is on this cusp. This is a very challenging place for many reasons. I mean, we have climate, we have not really a strong economy around here. So all these challenges really led me to want to be here. I think if we can develop a strong, viable system here, we can develop that sort of system anywhere. That challenge has always interested me.
Because you're on the ground in a place where it is difficult in some ways to get this started because of the lack of support structure, because of having to become a part of the local community and meet its needs while not being viewed as an outsider.
In many ways, this type of project would have been a lot easier if you'd been close to one of those meccas, you know, close to Boulder, close to Santa Fe, close to Santa Cruz, close to Bellingham, something like that, where there's already, you know, established interest. I think it could have been more successful in some regards. But by the same token, the success we have here is, I cherish it so much more in some respects. I feel like we've earned it. I guess it's also another reason why I like Appalachia more. It just, than the West Coast in some respects. It just seems more sincere to a degree, but that's probably a personal perspective.
Yeah, we could get into all kinds of thoughts of society and politics and everything that goes with it, but with some of the other pieces, how are you accomplishing the land sharing that you're doing? Like, is there some kind of a legal structure to allow for that?
Currently, no. We're working real hard to try to figure that out. I mean, the nonprofit is just an entity in itself. We don't currently have a mechanism of ownership. I think what the direction we're heading is to either let the nonprofit become an owner, which seems somewhat risky in some regards, or develop a separate trust with a separate board of directors that would be more focused on just land management and allow the nonprofit to continue its community service type work without being so focused on the land management decisions. We're looking for some checks and balances in the ownership structure that also give the transparency that allows the actual people that are involved to have the decision-making power.
Is your concern with the nonprofit becoming an owner of the property that the goals of the nonprofit would not match the goals of the long-term land management and land sharing?
I'm not sure if that's necessarily a concern as much as just trying to have a little separation between the two entities to allow them to operate at separate levels and have separate focuses. The breadth of what you try to accomplish is often a limiting factor. And I think as far as our organization, the Acres, we've been very successful at occupying the land and thinking in terms of, you know, a year-to-year and a five-year plan. But I think we would like to bring in a broader segment of our community to start talking about what to do with the 200 acres that we're dealing with here in terms of creating a public space for the future. It's yet to be understood, yet to be decided how that whole land tenure will proceed. I mean, we're really just in our first 15 years, we've been so engrossed with just sort of this expansion mode, building infrastructure, developing programs, reaching out to the community. At this juncture, organizationally, we're shifting more into a perennialization mode than a growth mode, where we're looking more at ensuring long-term staff tenure and ensuring long-term land stability for the organization and for the community. So there was this whole, you know, it took 15 years, but the catalyst type activity that really got things going and sort of we were able to really assess the possibilities more clearly. And now from this juncture, I think we need to act upon that knowledge and develop an enduring system. So it was sort of different phases. And like I said, this is over a long time horizon, really. I think, you know, some of this stuff actually sort of came here with this somewhat vague and definitely naive notion that some of this stuff could get accomplished in a five-year period. But I think more realistically it would get accomplished over a 30-year period where you're really getting in, getting established in the community, and then developing a system that you can have an enduring residency within this farm organization that becomes lifelong and multi-generational without necessarily having blood ties and family ties. It's coming along.
This goes back to your beginning and introduction to all of this. What put you in a mindset to want to do something like this? It's very different, very counter to what our normal, if you will, societal paths are in the United States. Was there something transformative that happened to, for you that got you to this place to think about this intergenerational, non-familial path of land tenure?
Well, I mean, it definitely is not something that I could say I had a particular epiphany. I think rather it's been a long-term assessment of what I did learn in college, which was the problems of the world. And just trying to look at that picture and seeking reasonable and rational alternatives. Things that, you know, for me, a lot of this stuff could be construed as somewhat socialist, communist, collective, cooperative. All these words are really scary to the conventional wisdom in this country. This individualistic type pioneer notion that we all can make our own way by ourselves and that's how you prove your worth. You know, I guess it never resonated with me, and my parents are really, I can credit them for giving me the opportunity to try to start thinking outside the box. If the system is broke, then we need to figure out a way to start taking apart the pieces and put them back together in a different way so it's more functional. But yeah, the whole litany of troubles of the world, we need to find a way that we recognize that we are all responsible. And to get there, I think we all need to be given responsibility. It's just gonna take a massive, you know, paradigm shift, and the legal system has to change and the economic system has to change. And so this is part of that process. And definitely I don't feel like we found the answer. I think the answer is in trying to seek solutions.
What you just said there, I like the way that sentence came together as an experiential expression of how we find a way forward. That it's in the work that we're doing that we're able to move forward as we seek for this goal, even as the goal may change over time because we find that what we're doing is working in one way but not in another.
Painful. It is very painful, but I don't have the mentality for like an academic approach for this. I don't have the genetic makeup for that. I just can't sit still and ponder it in that way. I feel very driven towards action and implementation. And so while it is very painful to try this stuff, and it definitely, you know, with any experiment, 99% of it is going to fail. For me, I've always equated this sort of courage a lot with stupidity, so it seems to run hand in hand with me that I'm sort of courageous stupid.
And yet you're doing all this work that's so inspirational for others, and I really appreciate that you're going through the pain and the struggle so that others may learn. Someone said to me once, wisdom is being able to learn from others' mistakes. And I think that it's important for people to hear these stories and these roads that we're on and to hear about the places where others have gone wrong so that then they will not go down that same path, that they can be saved that pain and find their own new struggles.
Yeah, yeah. No, there's a lot of salvation in this kind of experimentation. You really can find yourself. And my conscience is so clear from giving it all in this respect and being willing to set myself and this organization out there at times, not knowing if it's right or wrong or if it's going to be approved or disapproved. Or you just have to try, you know, with a positive attitude and try to, you know, make sure you can sleep good at night, shine the things you shine. Yeah, I feel very strongly about that. Get out and do it.
I think I could end on that, but I've got some other questions for you. From here, to move back to the farming work that you're doing, because I think about a quote from Masanobu Fukuoka that farming is actually about the cultivation of people, And I think that your comment about salvation speaks to that, the things that we can learn through doing. But you say that you're doing 4 acres of no-till hand development of the land for your intensive gardening, but you're on 200 acres. Is that correct?
Yep.
And then how much of the land would you say is in production as you're developing your orchard and for grazing your animals?
There's about, I would say, 8 acres cleared right now. And we've probably, you know, pasture animal space is about half of that. It's all pretty intensive, what we're doing. And we're bringing in a lot of outside nutrients. We're bringing in a lot of waste food, compost-type food scraps for the pigs, and bringing hay from off-site currently for our oxen. Those are inputs, definitely, into the system, energetic inputs into our system that we're gleaning off the industrial era currently to, it's just a better place than, you know, for the food scraps and stuff, better than putting it in a hole and trying to collect the methane 20 years later. For us, it just makes a lot more sense to use up the excess of the current system. The food production system, you know, the no-till and the handwork and trying to figure out how to perennialize our food system is where our manual labor is really taking place. There is an awful lot of handwork going on, weeding, mulching, sheet mulching, cutting back brush, trying to keep the jungle at bay and grow the food that we'd like to be growing in our field spaces. Very labor intensive, for sure.
With the food that you're growing, how many people on site is that feeding?
Everybody on site is getting fed real well, but we operate overnight accommodations, and we have a ton of these type of food events on a regular basis. So our overnight guests, we're feeding them. It's a way that helps us keep in business economically to have the overnight visitors and so forth, but it's also part of our educational process. The food that we're able to put on the table for breakfast is, you know, at least 75% of it is grown right on site. And that kind of opportunity is very unique in North America, where you can eat the food on site that was grown there. So it really is sort of an ultra kush bread and breakfast in some sense. This is very, very chic in some sense, but it's very, very normal for us. And by sort of making that leap and making that connection, it's what helps keep us afloat economically, and also is doing a tremendous job at transferring these ideas and these inspirations to a broader segment of the population. In terms of, you know, the food production, yeah, we're serving thousands of meals per year. Probably we are above a subsistence level, but we serve an awful lot of food to off-site visitors.
Thank you. That answers that very nicely for what I was looking for. When you said there about keeping yourselves afloat economically, I did want to ask, are you profitable as an organization?
Our economic system right now is we have to generate 6 figures a year. We have bills. We have insurance bills. We have payroll. The things that we're doing as community outreach programs cost money. Education is expensive. So we need to generate money. And we generate that money through a diverse stream. You know, there's probably 6 to 10 different streams of income that are all generating between $2,000 and $20,000. You know, from woodworking to cordwood to permaculture design class to breakfast to having pizza night to selling some nursery plants to doing maybe just a tiny bit of consultation or something like that. There's a broad range of activities that we're doing seasonally and based on our interest and our resource base and our time that we're able to generate that kind of revenue. We're really fortunate that we had a large initial investment that was supplied by my family that helped us create a community building in which we're able to use this infrastructure to generate revenue. The community building has overnight accommodations, it has a commercial kitchen, it has a wood shop. And from those 3 infrastructure pieces, we're able to generate quite a bit of revenue.
That upfront investment allowed you to have a long-term income for the site as you were developing it?
Bam. That's how it flows.
And that goes back to your earlier comment about having that luxury in the beginning to be able to devote the time to the rest of this work while you all were still working in other ways.
I was more or less the general contractor on the community building. It's not a small building. It took us about 3 years to complete. So for the first 3 years, that was our primary activity, was to build the gardens and build the multi-function community building so that then we could move forward with our programming. That was a doozy of the first couple of years.
And the last question I have will take us away from that and back to farming. When you said about you're using your pigs to help develop the land, could you speak a little bit more about how that process works?
The pig is just a remarkable animal, very helpful in many respects. It has that niche where it really loves to root. So when I initially moved up to Appalachia, there were these stories the old-timers would tell about getting your pigs to till your garden. You know, there was even rumor that if you let some pigs out in a field that you'd had a bunch of stumps in it, and you took yourself an iron bar and drove down below the stumps and put a little corn in there, then the pigs would pop the stumps and move them all down the hill, build a big pile, and then if you gave them a pack of matches, they would be able to light all the stumps on fire. But it's not true. None of that is true. The pigs will actually just eat the corn out from below the stumps and just leave the stumps there usually. They don't really, they're smarter than we are, so they know if they just eat the corn out that you'll probably bring some more corn. So we learned that the pigs wouldn't actually stump the field, but they will suppress the native vegetation. Like the northern forest really wants to grow back. It's been remarkable over the course of the last 200 years. I mean, we virtually cleared the place and it's grown right back. And it grows back from the stump oftentimes with a tremendous amount of energy. So the pigs are able to gnaw on all those sprouts, those water sprouts and so forth that are coming up, and suppress the vegetation that wants to come back. So after about a year or two of that, depending on how intensive, you know, how many animals you have on a certain space, you're able to go in there and the place looks more or less, you know, they've denuded the whole place of vegetation. And then at that juncture, what we typically do is go in with potatoes as our primary crop. We'll set up, just lay potatoes right on the ground in rows. And then through the course of the summer, you know, rows on contour, through the course of the summer, come in and add material. So by the end of the summer, when we're harvesting those potatoes, what's left is raised beds on contour. And then from there, we just come in and do annual crops and plant our orchard into that as well. And then the progression begins, and we're just using that as a vegetable and perennial field space. The pigs really do the fertility and the weed suppression that allows us to get in there and begin our species recomposition. The system works really good. I've been amazed. It takes some material. You know, you have to come up with the stuff to hill up the potatoes, compost, hay, straw, what have you, biomass. But then that biomass quickly becomes incorporated into your soil strata. And all those stumps that we were, you know, everybody was so worried about also become incorporated into that soil strata. And just thinking about, you know, the existing vascular system and the ability of those roots and those stumps to then become incorporated into the future fertility of that land base. That's more or less the process.
Thank you for that. I had this image when you said about giving pigs a pack of matches, that that you had two or three of them walking down the hill with a pack of matches in their mouth, and then one kind of uses its nose to push open the box, another one grabs one and strikes it. And
I gave them to them, I did, and they were playing with them, you know. They would light stuff on fire, but they wouldn't light the stumps on fire. I got some of this on video, too. You might want to see.
As a father of two young children, I know how much trouble that they can get into. I can't imagine, though, with pigs that are, they're probably at least as smart at this point. Well, thank you for that information, the story, the mental image that came with it. Is there anything else that you'd like to add to this conversation for the listeners?
For me, the really important component of this continued evolution of this term permaculture is the understanding that it is not designed for isolated usage. It is designed for implementation amongst us all. societal tool. It's not a tool for individuals. I feel very strongly that we need to recognize that. Using such information for the advantage of an individual is just a continued progression of the downfall of Western Civ. We need to find a way to renounce Descartes and move forward. I think we've taken a big step back in the last 400 or 500 years, and we just need to recognize that.
Well, I'll do the best that I can to get your story out there and to continue to expand on access to the information of permaculture. You keep working with all your experiments on the ground and letting us know how things are going.
Cool. All right, Scott. Yeah, keep up the good work, man.
All right. Thank you so much for joining me today, Josh.
All right. Let me know if I can help with anything else.
All righty.
Take care now.
And that was Josh Trott. I wrapped up this episode soon after the release of the interview with Eric Olson, so still had that chat with Eric fresh in my mind. What Josh is doing represents another way to consider how to make a living while doing something you love. In this particular case, in order to support D-Acres, it is through a diversity of income streams ranging from farming to the bed and breakfast, woodworking, and selling cordwood, among others. Rather than looking to one strategy to support what they're doing, they're using a broad range of ideas to make that happen. If one of those fail, there are others to rely on. It's part of what I think we may need to do moving forward in order to make permaculture a true career option for many. With that work, and I don't doubt at all that there's plenty to go around, is the salvation that Josh finds in his labor with the land, the animals, the products that come from it, and the people that come through it. I'm on a bit of a kick thinking about how all the ideas of the various guests interrelate in describing the broad umbrella of ideas we can consider as part of permaculture. I say this because Josh's efforts speak to the dignity of labor that Bob Tyson and I talked about. Josh's idea of land stewardship echoes Bob's thoughts about not despoiling some piece of land that doesn't need us, but to look for something that's already developed that does. In Josh's case, that isn't about going into a city, but looking for ways to preserve farmland so that it can be kept in perpetuity for the people that would choose to live and work there and doesn't require familial bonds. And then there's the experiences that Josh has gone through in order to get where he's at, starting, if you will, somewhat naively in the very beginning about what farming would be like, building a name for himself through what he did, overcoming those initial thoughts that he and his companions would grow exotic Asian greens and sell them to hip folks at $20 a pound, going from that first half bushel of garlic in the late 1990s to less than 20 years later, being well beyond subsistence, growing enough food to eat the majority of their meals from food grown on site, while also serving thousands of others to the people who come through, and still maintaining a well-stocked root cellar. Because he continued to move forward, each of those successes built on the ones before them, and though it took time, he and the others are left with something of value. Here's a working model to show others in the community and to the world. And going further back in the archives, to the interview with Ethan Hughes, I consider that thought that Ethan had about meeting people where they're at. Josh provides us another example of someone who's doing that. He came in as an outsider to a community, found the way that they worked, a place for himself within that, and is now a regular and involved member of his community. I'm still amazed at how each guest of this podcast finds their own way, and often for the things that they're not necessarily known for that we learn about in these conversations, and that as people proceed down similar paths, the results are so varied that there's still room for others to try their hand at the work and see if they can find their own place in this community of practitioners looking to build a better world. Lastly, and the thought I leave you with from the interview proper, was Josh's statement, quote, "I think the answer is in trying to seek solutions," end quote. We will find a way forward together by doing. Go out there and get started. I'll meet you along the way. If you're left with thoughts or questions after listening to this episode, feel free to reach me by email, show@thepermaculturepodcast.com, or give me a call. 717-827-6266. You can also send me a message on the Facebook page for the show, facebook.com/thepermaculturepodcast, or on Twitter, where I am @permaculturecst. Coming up next week on July 16th is Nikki Jabor, author of The Year-Round Vegetable Gardener. We'll talk about her book and what it's like to grow in a colder climate. After that, on July 23rd is Arthur Haynes. He and I discuss wild foods and foraging. Ending July and heading into August will be Larry Korn and then Ann Stone. Until the next time, take care of the earth, yourself, and each other, and the legal. The Permaculture Podcast is released under a Creative Commons Attribution, No Derivatives, Non-Commercial License. Feel free to share it. Just tell people where you got it from, and don't change or sell it.